Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It's always a delight, and we have the chance to indulge in it each week, to have a chance to talk with one of the most intelligent people I know, especially on both today's version or facets of the war for the free world, as well as those of yesteryear. She is, of course, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist and now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net. You can also find her extraordinary new audiobook, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, at all the right places. And you can also check out her other best-selling book, Death of the Grown-Up. Diana West, it's good to have you. Welcome back, as always.
Oh, wonderful to be back, Frank.
So, Diana, I wanted to pick your brain about a couple of things that have been developing in recent days. Of course, in the course of the Passover Easter weekend, the Palestinians under Hamas's influence in the Gaza Strip have begun what amounts to an attack on Israel immediately by pressing against the border and throwing rocks and that sort of thing. I'm interested in your take on what is going on there. The Israelis have returned fire. There have been some losses of life. Are we likely to see this spiraling in the 6 weeks? They claim they're going to continue this pressure in the run-up to the so-called Nakba, the catastrophe of the establishment of the Jewish state.
Well, I think that that is what Hamas wants to see, wants to create, wants to direct and foment. I think this is a resurgence of the kind of theater of blood that we so often see coming out of Islamic terrorist organizations and all revolutionary terrorist organizations that are certainly timed to coincide with the move by the United States of our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is designed to coincide with the Israeli Independence Day. I think, though, that this is not an isolated international event either, because we are also seeing in our own hemisphere, we're seeing similar uptick in this kind of, again, theatrical display using real people, of course, that seems to be orchestrated with this movement of some 1,000 to 2,000 people, I believe, from Honduras that are being given some kind of magic go card through Mexico heading toward our own border.
That's right. Let me come back to that in a minute, Diana, because it's a very important, I think, parallel of kind. But just before we leave the Israeli situation, we're having, of course, calls from the United Nations, which reflexively finds cause to denounce Israel and to make one of its, if not actually its, top agenda in both the General Assembly and in its various tentacles. The attacks on Israel's legitimacy and its self-defense and the like. There are claims now that the Israelis will not conduct an investigation, so somebody else must conduct an investigation of what happened in this incident. And yet, Diana, I mean, as you say, there is a theater of blood quality to this. Wherever possible, Hamas and its friends have used innocents to be those whose blood is shed for the purposes of maximizing, you know, the international outcry against Israel. This seems so completely cynical. Is there anything that the Israelis, or for that matter, we, can do to discourage this kind of behavior by, obviously, in the first instance, the Palestinians, and not less important, the so-called international community?
I don't know. I mean, this is really just a continuation of the same war on Israel's legitimacy. I think that in terms of the parallels, I suppose it becomes a matter of when a country decides that these are acts of war against it and actually stop them. I mean, this is allowed to kind of fester and continue in a very injurious way to all concerned. I think that the key here, though, is this idea of war on Israel's legitimacy. I think it's a war also on our legitimacy, these kinds of attacks on borders and sovereignty and indeed existence. And the word you hear in both places is this notion of expropriation, that this land was taken from another group. I see a parallel also with this surreal horror going on in South Africa, where the South African Parliament is now very calmly debating and indeed planning the quote expropriation of farmland owned by white South Africans that has been part of a long campaign, a violent campaign trying to kill South African farmers and now trying to take their land without compensation. This notion of illegitimacy of these different groups driven by these same kinds of revolutionary forces. I think that there is a way to understand them all in consecutive, or they're not in parallel. Well, I guess they are kind of in parallel with slightly different sets of data points around them, of course, but there is a drive against the legitimacy of various entities, Western entities, and this is very frightening when you see it orchestrated. And I think that the timing is also very concerning because it seems to be building to various crescendos. So where this goes, it becomes very difficult to see. We see disaster, but it's very difficult for a state to, for example, use real bullets against people who are not apparently armed except with stones. I mean, that always has been a problem in terms of international community outrage and so on, who never have outrage for the actual assault.
Well, it's an important point you make on several different counts. I mean, stones have, of course, been used as lethal weapons from the dawn of mankind. And this idea that people are harmless simply because they're wielding, often with great accuracy through these slingshots, you know, stones at soldiers is nonsense. They don't do much against tanks and, you know, body armor, that's for sure, but they can nonetheless maim and, in the case of lucky shots, even inflict mortal wounds on those that they're targeting. And Diana, to your point about expropriation or the sense of the grievance of those who don't have what others do against them, does seem to be animating a lot of this. And I do wonder at what point, you know, as Donald Trump tweeted the other day, he seems to be anticipating this problem and noting it, specifically the caravan coming our way from Central America, with the obvious connivance and cooperation and assent of Mexico. And he is indicating that there will be consequences for Mexico in terms of trade, in terms of other aspects of our relationship. It is coming at an unfortunate moment because there is an election underway there, and it is likely that all of this will, if nothing else, propel forward a very hostile, indeed anti-American government under Luis Obrador. Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk about. I look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your time today. Next up, we will be speaking with Kenneth Timmerman about what this all entails in the Middle East, and not least the Iranian dimension. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Kenneth Timmerman, a man of many parts, not least a superb investigative reporter, an activist, the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, a novelist, an author of nonfiction works as well, the most recent of which is Shadow Warriors, Traitors, Saboteurs, and The Party of Surrender, A new book is in the works. It is called ISIS Begins, a novel which we await with bated breath. In the meantime, we're delighted to have a chance to visit with Ken. Thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on, Frank. It's a pleasure.
Well, I thought we might start with your take, Ken. You've spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and you know in particular the bad guys, among whom are Hamas. I've talked a little bit with Dinah West a moment ago about what Hamas is doing currently at the border of the Gaza Strip with Israel, and I'd love to get your take on it as well. It's clearly a provocation. It's having, I guess, the desired effect in terms of producing the loss of innocent lives and casting Israel as the brutal oppressor. Yet where does the truth lie, as you see it, Ken?
I think you've mentioned the key word, which is provocation. Hamas, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, aims with their Iranian backers to attack Israel using waves of children. It's a bit, if you wish, a remake of the human wave strategy that the Iranians used against Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. They put children out on the front lines, and then because there's so many of them and because they're armed and because they're threatening to invade, the people on the other side shoot them at some point or another. And this is clearly, I believe, what Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran are planning to do with Israel soon in a very big way. You have also these what's called the Pollywood staged actions. And thankfully, these are now being exposed. The Israelis themselves are exposing them as really staged attacks where they show children being shot by theoretically by Israeli soldiers. In fact, they're not. They're completely staged events and put out there as propaganda. So luckily, many people are now seeing through that for what it is.
This is an information warfare, I guess, is the one way of describing it. And you've spent a lot of time assessing this phenomenon. It's unfortunately not alone as a product of the Palestinians and their jihadist elements. It's happening elsewhere in that region, not least at the hands of the Turks. And I'd be very interested, Ken Timmerman, in your thoughts on what Turkey is up to on several counts. I think you have correctly regarded them, as do I, as a threat increasingly. But talk, especially from the vantage point of your extensive experience with the Kurds in Iraq and in Syria, Ken, about what the Turks are doing to them and the prospect that the United States is going to remove the relatively small number of forces that it has in that in Syria at the moment, according to President Trump.
Well, Frank, I fear that the Turks are preparing a future genocide against the Kurds, no more, no less. They have, when they went into Afrin recently with their allies of the Free Syrian Army, which Obama had backed at a certain point, they were pillaging everything. They were murdering, they were raping, they were plundering, and they were doing this in a systematic way. And according to the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, who normally is against the Syrian regime and backs the rebels, here was a rebel force, a so-called rebel force coming in. And the Syrian Observatory said this was systematic, organized plundering of Kurdish property and lives because the Turks hate the Kurds. I believe that the Kurds are a natural ally of the United States. They tend to be secular. They are trying to form democratic, you know, pockets of democratic governance. The area in Afrin and in Manbij that they have been controlling since 2012 has been the most peaceful area, at least the most peaceful area held by rebel forces. And they have been protecting Christians at the same time. Their government in Rojava includes Assyrian Christians. So I think our natural allies are the Kurds. The Turks are an Islamist dictatorial regime under Erdogan, trying to reestablish the Islamic caliphate. They say that openly. Erdogan publicly talks about reestablishing the Ottoman Empire and the caliphate. And I am surprised, frankly, that NATO has not invoked some of the authority of the North Atlantic Treaty to sanction Turkey for having violated the borders of a neighboring country without provocation and without the authorization of NATO.
This is a very important question, Ken. I have been told that the NATO alliance really lacks the means by which to punish a member, let alone expel them from NATO. Is that incorrect?
Legally, I can't answer that legally, Frank, but certainly we are the United States of America, and we have lots of means at our disposal as a government to punish Turkey for violating the NATO treaty. For example, there was recently a trial of Turkish state bankers and money launderers in New York. The Treasury Department has got ample authority to sanction Turkish state-owned banks for money laundering. They could do this under the Patriot Act, and the Turks are not at all prepared for that. I think that would have a pretty dramatic impact on the Turkish economy, frankly.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, something that I think we can do unilaterally as a nation and should indeed, though I understand that Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis has been pressing for an open dialogue, as he puts it, with the Turks to kind of, mollify them, perhaps, or at least attenuate somewhat the disagreements between us. But the more we hear about this Ottoman imperial ambition of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Ottoman slap, as it's called, that they seem to be interested in applying to others around them, including perhaps our own forces, it does behoove us to be taking a very, very dim view of what Turkey is up to. In fact, we have a new book coming out entitled Ally No More from the Center for Security Policy Press, and I'll be interested in talking with you about that, Ken Timmerman. Let me ask you about one other piece of this, though. You have, of course, as I mentioned, been very active for years on behalf of democracy in Iran. In fact, you were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for your work in that space. Is it the case, Ken, that the Turks are actively collaborating with the government of Iran, including in ways that are clearly undermining the sanctions regime against the Iranians, such as it is at the moment?
Absolutely. The most recent demonstration of that was this court case in New York, the Zarab case of a Turkish / Iranian dual national who laundered an estimated $100 billion on behalf of the Iranian regime, this at the peak of the sanctions, international sanctions regime, and with the direct full cooperation of the Turkish government, including kickbacks to Erdogan and his family. All of this is now in the public record. And certainly Turkey and Iran have been cooperating in whacking the Kurds together. I was in the Kandil Mountains in northern Iraq along the border with Iran a couple of years ago when there was a joint Turkish-Iranian series of strikes against the Kurdish positions, both the Turkish Kurds and the Iranian Kurds up in those mountains. So they have a long history of this. They cooperate on this type of thing, going after the Kurds. And I would not be surprised to see them cooperating in a much more active military sense in the future as well.
Again, very much at odds with NATO's interests and certainly those of the United States. Ken, I did want to ask you, while we're talking about the Kurds, I understand there's some sort of deal that the government of Iraq in Baghdad has struck with the Kurds in recent days. Can you shed any light on that?
Well, they have been negotiating for many, many months. The Kurds have been demanding that the Baghdad government live up to its commitment under the Constitution to pay the salaries of government workers in Kurdish areas and to share the oil revenues. And apparently they have struck some kind of deal on that. Look, we'll have to see if it holds. But the gist of it is to open up the airports in Erbil and Sulaymaniyah to international traffic, because Kurdistan has been Iraqi Kurdistan has been isolated from the rest of the world since September.
Yeah. Well, and it's high time that we get that sorted. As you say, Ken Timmerman, I think it makes eminent sense for us to be standing with the Kurds strategically, and it's a scandal that we've not done so. Ken, one last question quickly. Mark Dubowitz, a colleague from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, is writing in the Wall Street Journal today about the possibilities of getting the Europeans to provide Donald Trump a deal he can't refuse on Iran. It won't be what he's seeking, apparently, but it would be something that's kind of half a loaf. What's your make on this? And in the absence of H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson, two champions of appeasing Iran, and their replacement by John Bolton and we hope Mike Pompeo, who are very much opposed to that approach. Where do you think this stands, and where is it likely to go from here?
Well, I think this is dead in the water, and it's a futile effort, and only serves the craven purposes of British and German and French companies seeking to do business with a murderous regime in Tehran. I have been saying for years, you know that, we have spoken about this, Frank, that the problem is not Iranian nuclear weapons. That's not a problem for us. The problem is an Iranian regime which is hell-bent on destroying America, destroying our allies and attacking us, which believes in Islamic jihad. It's part of their constitution. That's our problem. It's the regime that is the problem, not even the nuclear weapons. I believe we need to focus on the regime. I think John Bolton is going to be more inclined to focus on the regime. We have tremendous ways of undermining the regime in Tehran. They're weaker than people think, and I hope that we get down to business soon.
Amen. Ken Timmerman, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's insightful and fascinating to pick your brains, and we'll look forward to doing so again. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, and we again await with great expectation ISIS begins. We'll talk with you again soon, my friend. Thanks for joining me. Next up, we will speak with Bill Gertz about developments inside the ring and beyond. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for a tour inside the ring, and no one provides that tour with more effect than our friend Bill Gertz. That is, of course, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. A heroically impressive investigative reporter for many years, specializing in the national security arena. He is senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Let's talk about China, and in particular what you have been teaching us, Bill, on the basis of some testimony of late about China's spy masters, the larger capability that they've put in place for cyber warfare and the purposes to which it's being applied.
This is my latest Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times, which discusses how the latest U.S. Trade Representative report on Chinese technology theft and intellectual property theft reveals for the first time one of the key players involved in China's cyber attacks. And it's a major general. His name is Liu Xiaobei. And he is the one who is behind some of the major cyber attacks. And I thought it was interesting, and I was able to outline what he's done in terms of basically working to attack our businesses, our government, private sector, academia. And it's part of this massive Chinese effort to steal American technology, and of which the Trump administration, for the first time, is actually taking steps to counteract. They're imposing some $50 to $60 billion in tariffs, but those tariffs don't cover the losses that the U.S. has sustained from these Chinese cyber attacks, which have cost, according to this USTR report, anywhere from $280 billion to $600 billion annually. It's a massive loss. And hopefully, like I say, identifying the key players. Now, back in 2014, they indicted 5 PLA hackers, but this is the first time they identified one of the key leaders behind this. And my guess is that the next step will be they'll impose some type of financial sanctions on this major general, who's part of what they call the 3PLA, or the Third Department of the General Staff.
We're looking at the Chinese now retaliating today, preemptively, actually, by imposing $3 billion worth of tariffs on something like 128 different American products. Bill, this may or may not dissuade the president from proceeding with his tariffs on a variety of Chinese products, but as you say, aimed at trying to establish some costs to them for engaging in this technology theft. whether it's through, you know, cyber attacks, as you know, or simply expropriating it from people who have to transfer their seed corn technologies as part of the price of doing business in China. It's really a comprehensive kind of vacuum cleaning, isn't it, of our technology capabilities.
Yeah, and again, there's been a major shift in dealing with China, and it started with the release of the National Security Strategy, which identified China basically as a threat. And, you know, I've been covering this for 3 decades now, and I've been seeing that China's not a threat, we want a strong China, were some of the buzzwords that successive administrations have used, and now finally we're recognizing that that the threat posed by China is dangerous and it's growing, and they're finally taking steps to counter it.
In the economic warfare space, most especially. But there's also the old-fashioned kinetic kind of threat too, Bill Gertz. Tell us what the Chinese have been up to of late in terms of flexing their muscles in the South China Sea. I gather there have been some fairly impressive exercises there, and belies this whole notion of really the peaceful rise of China, doesn't it?
Yeah, they've been engaged in a pretty large-scale naval exercises in the South China Sea, and it follows some pretty impressive U.S. exercises. We've had a number of warship passages, which for some reason the Pentagon doesn't want to announce anymore, but now the Chinese are doing a big exercise there to try and claim that this strategic waterway, which sees up to $3 trillion annually in trade pass through it, is there. Maritime territory. And so they're making a big show of force there. But the U.S. has also been flying bombers there. Also, we had a carrier there last month. So obviously the strategic messaging on the South China Sea is picking up from both sides, the U.S. and the Chinese side.
The problem, as I see it, though, Bill, and I'd like your thoughts on this, is that unfortunately, impressive as they may be, these power projection exercises or demonstrations by the United States are by their nature ephemeral. The Chinese have built these fortified islands and therefore have a permanent ability to project power in the region, do they not?
Yes. And what they've done with the militarization, you know, first they built up these islands, 3,200 acres of new islands, located in three strategic points, north, northeast, and south. And then now they're militarizing them, and they've put in missile emplacements, but for very short-range naval missiles. But the missile emplacements can also be used for much longer-range anti-ship cruise missiles, and that's what's got the Pentagon very concerned. Yeah, they don't seem to have a strategy for undoing the damage that the Chinese have done by building and now militarizing these islands. And I think that's something that really is going to require a much greater effort on the part of the U.S., especially the Trump administration needs to step up its game to get those islands demilitarized. That should be the first step.
Amen. Bill, let me turn to another topic that you've addressed that we've touched on a little bit earlier in the program, namely Syria. There is talk of the United States withdrawing its forces at the very moment that the Turks, among others, are upping their game. There was also apparently, according to your report, another close call on an attack by U.S. warplanes on Russian forces in Syria that seemed to be crossing lines of demarcation and putting them in close proximity to our forces. What's the story there, and what do you make of this idea of our pulling out?
Well, yeah, first of all, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis revealed to reporters the other day that these Russian mercenary forces, it's something called the private military group, the Wagner Group, and they're working with pro-Syrian government forces, and they had kind of reached an agreement that they wouldn't cross the Euphrates River, and these forces once again crossed the Euphrates. They did this back in February and lost, and as a result, the U.S. launched a massive airstrike and killed about 200 Russian mercenaries. They saw the same kind of thing building up again. These mercenaries were building defensive emplacements, berms, and putting guns in place. And this time, rather than use the traditional military channel, they had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford, called General Gerasimov, the Russian chief of staff, and said, look, you guys want to lose another 200 people, keep your people there, otherwise you better get them out of there. And this time the Russians did it. Again, the reason they didn't do it the first, didn't want to give up the deniability, the fact that these were paramilitary mercenaries that are backed by Moscow, and they didn't want to have the U.S. believe that they were under Russian control, but they dropped that pretense in order to prevent a second bombing.
And there's no question in your mind, Bill Gertz, that these are effectively proxies for the Russian military, right?
Yeah, I recently interviewed the head of Ukrainian intelligence, and the Ukrainians have collected a large body of intelligence showing that these forces are effectively funded by Russian intelligence, the military intelligence, the GRU. As for pulling out of Syria, you know, I mean, the president has been active in trying to end U.S. engagements overseas. We just lost another special forces guy recently in Syria. And I know that the efforts to try and defeat the ISIS are working, but now it's becoming a battle over whether Bashar Assad can be ousted, and that's not the mission of those forces. So that's probably what was behind the president's idea of pulling out those troops.
I'm not terribly keen, frankly, on forces being in Syria, I have to say, but the possibilities that the Turks will perceive this as an invitation to move even more aggressively against what are, I think, natural allies of this country, the Kurds, is not a happy prospect. Bill, let me turn to one other thing. The president, as you know, apparently has been noodling the idea that since he's being stymied by the Congress on building a wall, which, if anything, this caravan headed our way from Honduras reinforces is urgently needed, that the military, having now had its coffers swelled a bit by the recent omnibus, is rich, as he puts it, and therefore perhaps in a position to pay for the wall. You cover closely, of course, the Pentagon and understand better than just about anybody the actual circumstances in which the military finds itself today. Would you characterize it as rich, or are there others pretty compelling demands on those resources for our national security?
Yeah, the latest omnibus bill did plus up the military budget. I'm not sure that Mattis is going to be all that keen on using defense money to build the border wall. His most important priority is to redress some of the readiness issues that the military is facing. Basically, his strategy is to refashion the military into a what he refers to as a more agile and more lethal force.
Yeah, we will be following it closely, but we do need those readiness shortfalls addressed urgently. I think there's no question about that. Bill Gertz, thank you for your tour inside the ring. As always, it's great to visit with you, my friend. Your book, iWars, War and Peace in the Information Age, is required reading. Folks, check it out. Bill, come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang about developments in China, the trade war, and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house virtually. We're glad to catch up with him ever, but particularly on the occasion of an important piece that he has written in the Daily Beast, where he is a featured columnist. His thesis is that we may be at the cusp of something really big as a result of what North Korea is up to. We last talked with Gordon as there were reports that the dictator of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, was paying a visit to China. We have now established that that did indeed happen. And to find out what it might portend, I'm delighted to welcome back the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, Gordon Chang. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So you've made a comparison that's chilling between what's happening now in Northeast Asia to what happened in Eastern Europe, Sarajevo, the eve of World War One. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, everyone wonders how the assassination of an Austrian archduke could lead to global conflict. And there are a number of very haunting parallels between 1914 and 2018. You know, on the eve of World War One, we saw basically uncertainty and complexity in the international system. Countries weren't sure who was on whose side and how all of this would occur. Too many countries involved, and that made it very difficult for leaders to try to manage what should have been a situation that history should have forgotten. Today, the issue is the same because we have, for instance, North Korea and China. And you mentioned Kim Jong-un returning from Beijing, this indicating that perhaps China is behind North Korea more so than most people thought. And this is an issue because if we were to strike North Korea's nuclear and missile facilities, we need to know whether China would actually come to North Korea's aid. The other thing that I'm concerned about, Frank, is that even if China weren't going to support North Korea after a U.S. strike, we also know that Putin would probably use the occasion to press eastern Ukraine even harder than he is now, maybe even move against the Baltics. The Iranians would certainly do something, and China could press Taiwan, India, who knows? So this is something where we could see conflict in Europe and both ends of Asia at the same time. And we've got to be concerned that we will be able to meet these challenges should we strike North Korea. So there are many issues involved, and they do resemble what happened in 1914 because of the complexity and the number of countries involved.
Gordon, this is, as I say, chilling, but I think such an important insight because, as you've indicated, we don't often think about historical precedents, let alone understand how they came about. And unfortunately, there are conditions that could give rise to another global conflict. And unfortunately, it seems as though some of them have been exacerbated by U.S. policies for quite some time. Gordon, is the possibility of a trade war with China one of the things that might contribute to such a cataclysmic train wreck?
That's an important question, Frank, because, you know, we tend to think of trade in trade terms. We tend to think of North Korea and nuclear weapons in, you know, another way. We stovepipe our thinking. But these issues are occurring at the same time, and they complicate matters. So I think that the worsening relations with Beijing across the board, something which I believe is necessary, by the way, because we've had quote-unquote friendly relations because we haven't confronted the Chinese on very dangerous conduct. But nonetheless, these issues do affect each other. We won't know how they will bump into each other, but nonetheless, we can be sure that they will have an effect.
Gordon, speaking of some of the forces at work behind this, in our previous conversation with Bill Gertz, he made reference to a statistic which I had not heard before, frankly, in terms of the magnitude of the intellectual property theft that is taking place. I understand this is not entirely China-induced, but a fair amount of it is. But he said that a recent study found that it might be on the order of $600 billion per year. That's simply staggering. It's hard to believe we've got that much technology to steal in any given year. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, he's referring to the IP Commission report. That was a report in 2013 that was updated in 2017. It's better known as the Blair-Huntsman report. And in 2017, they updated their estimates of the annual loss of U.S. IP. And in 2017, they said it was anywhere from $225 billion to $600 billion. And that's total, but most of it is China. And also, those $600 billion number, as high as it is, as unbelievable as it is, are also numbers that you will hear from industry sources. So there is a belief that the number is at the high end of the range. Whatever it is, even if it's at the low end, it's much too much. And the United States, which has an innovation economy, can't stand that. We have an economy which is no longer based on manufacturing, but is based on innovation. And if the Chinese steal the fruits of that innovation, we don't have very much of a future. So this is absolutely critical that we protect our technology. It's absolutely critical that we develop it. And we're in a race right now where the Chinese are ahead in quantum computing, quantum communications. We have a thin lead in artificial intelligence. We're struggling for control of 5G wireless communication. This is, I think, Frank, the critical competition with China in the next decade.
Well, let me drill down on that a little bit, Gordon, because you've studied this closely, I know, for a long time. The question that arises is we have long prided ourselves on being, as you say, an innovation society and having, you know, a critical advantage in being able to create technology applications, whereas others, notably but not exclusively the Chinese, have often simply either bought or more often simply absconded with our technology and then brought it to market and then frequently driven out of business the companies that did the innovation because of their competitive advantages in labor, particularly, I guess. Is that changing now, Gordon? Are the fruits of the immense investment the Chinese have made in both educating students and presumably now teachers in American universities, in hard sciences and engineering and the like, now giving rise, as well as to the improvement in their own educational system, probably in part as a result of the infusion from America of know-how, that they're developing a cadre of highly skilled engineers and scientists and innovators that may knock the pegs out from under that competitive advantage we've long held?
Absolutely, the Chinese are on the road to doing that. Now, China is not as fearsome as they appear, but nonetheless, they're making extremely fast progress. And as I mentioned, in the quantum area, because they've been able to attract engineers from other countries, you know, they're ahead of us, and they're very far ahead of us, 2-3 years, 5 years, something along that line. And quantum is going to be very critical for communications, for instance. The Chinese have had these quantum transmissions. We can't break them. And so they're, at least for the present moment, are unhackable and very well may be unhackable full stop, depending on the physics of it. But we got to remember that this whole issue of quantum started with the United States. It started with Einstein. And yet the Chinese, through various means, have been able to steal the march from us. As I mentioned, we're still ahead of in AI, but we could lose that because China's putting a lot of state money into that. And 5G is a struggle right now. I mean, that's the whole issue of Qualcomm versus Huawei. And so right now, we have to be concerned that the Chinese have been able to do this. Now, there's a certain limit to innovation that the Chinese have because of the nature of their system. But there are limits right now that are not affecting their progress and won't affect their progress for a very long time. So their system right now is able to produce outsized gains. You got to go back to the space race. Who put the first satellite in orbit? Who put the first human in orbit? It wasn't the United States. And the United States was only able to catch up because we had state-directed programs as well.
Yeah, it's high time industrial policy be revisited, Gordon. And most especially, unless and until we can stop having companies that, as the price of doing business in China, wind up transferring their seed corn technology, as I discussed with Bill Gertz. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I look forward to continuing our conversation with you next week. In the meantime, stay well, my friend, and I hope the rest of you will be joining us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.